The thing that was always coming back to me, especially in my early years, was you've never ridden a bike before at a high level. And that is true. I've never competitively competed on a bike. But it doesn't mean I can't help you go fast. And I think once you can break that barrier down and sort of open a few minds, people will follow. So I just knew I had to be right on for one or two people for other people to follow as well. You are right. There was a lot of questions about the lactate tolerance or length, as they call it. And I just said, look, you've always done this type of training and you've always gone this fast. Let's try this type of training. And I broke down exactly what the determinants and why I thought it was useful and try to give them as I think that the in vogue term is empowering the athletes and knowing why they're doing it rather than do it because I say. And the reason why I did that is A, that's my nature, but B, they weren't going to just say, oh, this guy's won a world record or been a world champion before. He knows what he's doing. It's more of, okay, I have to explain my way of thinking rather than tell you my way of thinking for you to buy in. Now, out of the six people I had in that group, I think sort of three to four bought into it. And then subsequently went on to break the world record. I think more and more people did join in and got equal success.
Hello and welcome back to the Supporting Champions podcast. I'm Steve Ingham, and if this is your first time tuning in, then you're in for a treat. This is where we explore the often invisible aspects of achieving greatness and aspiring to perform, whether in sport, business, or life in general. We're not just about the headlines here. We're about the fine print, the strategies, the setbacks, and the comebacks that make the journey worthwhile. And we talk to experts from various fields, from coaches and scientists to leaders and, of course, performers, those people who are out there trying. So it's not just about the performers. These are also about the people behind the scenes, the ones who are making champions what they are. This podcast isn't just for the elites or the top professionals. It's for anyone who believes in pushing their own boundaries, who believes in the power of progress over perfection. It's for anyone who's committed to improving, to learning, and to taking action. Whether you're a student, a professional, or someone simply interested in personal growth, there's something here for you. So if you're ready to dig deeper and apply some real-world insights to your own life, you're in the right place.
Hi, I'm Holly Calvert, professional golfer and co-founder of Athlete Now, and we're proud sponsors of the Supporting Champions podcast. Athlete Now was created with a vision to provide a dedicated space where proven practitioners can connect with athletes and coaches, offering the support needed to reach peak performance. Our platform is designed to make these connections seamless, empowering athletes and coaches to search for and access the best support for their journey. But what can Athlete Now offer you? For practitioners, a place to showcase your services, supported by a platform that appreciates and understands the value of your expertise. We offer you the opportunity to reach a wider audience, connecting with athletes and coaches who are in search of the specialized support you provide. Athletes and coaches, free access to search for services that meet your specific needs. Our platform allows you to filter searches by location, experience, accreditation, and type of expertise, ensuring you can find the right support exactly when and where you need it. But why join Athlete Now? Well, for practitioners, it's your chance to offer what you do best, supporting athletes and coaches in achieving their goals. By joining our community, you're not just listing your services, you're becoming part of a network dedicated to excellence in performance support. Athletes and coaches, signing up gives you the access to expertise, whether you're looking to enhance your performance, recover from an injury, or refine your strategy. The right support is just a few clicks away. We built Athlete Now to bridge the gap between sporting ambition and performance expertise. By facilitating these crucial connections, we aim to support athletes in meeting their goals and practitioners in expanding their reach. Visit us now at theathletenow.com to get started.
In this episode, we spotlight the journey, insights, and experiences of Mehdi Cordy. With a rich and varied background from biomedical sciences to aerospace physiology to accountancy to mice in the Andes, yes, you heard me correctly, and then ultimately into a career in sports science and eventually coaching at the elite end of cycling. First, Mehdi was at British Cycling as a sports scientist and then coached the para team to the Tokyo Paralympic Games. Then Mehdi moved on to the Dutch National Cycling Federation and is currently creating outstanding success in his role as head coach of track sprinting. And when I say outstanding success, Mehdi truly encapsulates getting bang for the buck, literally the money. That is, in sports like cycling, a mix of technology and human performance, generally the more money you put in, the better the results you get. And Mehdi and his small team at the Dutch Federation have created disproportionate success by focusing on what matters most. Think massive gains rather than marginal gains. And Mehdi's experiences offer a rare glimpse into the high performance delivered with real imagination, creativity, priority, and constraints-led innovation. So irrespective of whether you like cycling or not, or if you do, there's some juicy detail about riding a 1 kilometre time trial very fast. Mehdi's insights are more about a way of thinking and working that breaks the mould of that more is better idea. And it can be applied to a range of different systems, teams and pursuits. Mehdi, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Very well. Thank you for having me.
Oh, no, my absolute pleasure. And it's been amazing to see how things are progressing for you. So I'd love to chat to you about that over the last few years. And maybe we just have a bit of a catch up, really.
Absolutely. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Why don't you start us off? Just give me for those who don't know you and your background, just give me a bit of the biog. Just explain where you've sort of come from, where you were born, who you're raised by. Well, just give me your biog in terms of what you've been up to.
Okay, so born in Loughborough, of all places, which is where you spend a lot of your time. Yeah, so my dad was at the university and doing a PhD in engineering, not sport. And then we moved to Manchester and then Cambridge, that's what I consider my hometown. It was strange. I was always interested in sport, but I was the only member of my family that was interested in sport. So for some reason, despite being born in Loughborough, my dad being at Loughborough University, never guided into a sport, or even, I think my parents only watched me at one sporting event in my life. So it was something I kind of took up out of an interest, which is a story in itself. And then I was always interested in sports and sports science, but rather ashamedly, I kind of believed the hype where it was kind of, you know, it's not really a subject. And I thought, you know what, I'll do something that is a subject, which was biomedical science at Manchester, which is where I ended up after swearing I'd never go back after I finished my degree. So after my degree in biomedical science, yeah, I was like, I'm done with this place. I don't want to go into science. I don't want to go into the biomedical world either. So I decided to be an accountant. And that didn't last very long. I didn't pass an exam and was fired pretty quickly. But my persistence, for some reason, or my pride, got in the way, and I carried trying on to be an accountant. And then I realized I wasn't. And speaking to my dad, he was like, it's clear you don't want to be one. Your passion's not there. Do something you're passionate about. And at the time, I was a rower, went into a full-time rower, a largely average full-time rower. And I was just very curious about the training. You know, I actually read one of your papers about, you know, the training type, and I was very curious, like, why is this the only modality of training that we're given at every level? I wasn't improving as I wanted to, probably from a genetics and a potential point of view. But obviously, I thought, you know, maybe there's different ways of investigating training sciences, or is there a different way to get better? And that kind of just sparked my interest. And I went and did a master's at King's College in aerospace physiology. And my passion just lied in sport. And I was lucky enough to apply for a PhD with the English Institute of Sport in association with British Cycling in Manchester. So I went back after swearing I'd never go back. And I was looking at essentially physiology, or the training sciences of sprint cycling. And that was a really good area for me to kind of grow and develop, because it was just the beauty of the IS, what it was called the IS then, and the air and the space it was at. It was very much you can do what you want. So I engaged a lot of practitioners, including people at Len Parker Simpson, where I also engage in the endurance side of things, because I didn't know anything about it. I didn't want to be a one-trick pony. And I just learned a lot about physiology and training and how that influences track cyclists in particular. And my knowledge grew and grew and grew, and became the sports scientist or the physiologist for the paracycling team. Then became the coach of the paracycling team, and then got offered a position with a Dutch Olympic team, track cycling. And here I am now.
Here you are. So you've tried to avoid Manchester at all costs. So it sounds like you're going to get drawn back there at some point. But what was that early stage for you in terms of just you thinking you needed you wanted to go and do biomedical sciences? You've done aerospace physiology. You've tried to become an accountant and a rower. during that period of time, what was going on for you? Were you still sort of searching? Was there a sense of not drifting, but you were thinking, I probably should rather than I want to?
You've just summed it up there perfectly. Like, it was, I thought, I should be seen to be doing this. I should be seen having a so-called respectable career, a respectable career choice. Everyone around me was working at big corporate firms, earning infinitely more than me, having houses and cars. And I've never, like I said, I was still living in a house share when I was 30. And so it was very much, almost having to be seen. And it was actually the point where I was just like I said, when my dad kind of shook me a bit and was saying, do what you're passionate about, because that will drive you and you will eventually be good at it, because you want to be good at it rather than having to be seen to be good at it. And it was kind of a directed drift after I realized my accounting career was sort of not going to happen, because I wanted to get into sort of science and physiology, but I didn't, a lot of universities didn't really look at me because I did apply late. An opening happened in King's College London by chance, and I was based in London at the time, but that opened up so many more opportunities. So I went to Peru with the Peruvian Andes, did a project there for Hugh Montgomery, who you might know from the face of the COVID pandemic in the UK. And then I did a project in Brazil about CPR in space, and that ended up getting a position in the European Astronaut Centre. But all that kind of fed back to one thing. I wanted to work in elite sport or elite performance, because I just love seeing a tangible outcome of someone's development or work or body of work that you've put in. And it always dragged me back to that, really.
I had the privilege and honour of working with Hugh on the Research Excellence Framework. It would have been a decade ago now. And it was incredible just to sit next to him and listen to his logic and thinking. So what were you doing in Peru?
I was in a copper mine in the Andean Mountains. So it was a project that... So I wrote a lot of emails and mail merges, so old school letters to people, and a lot of them just replied back saying no, sorry, or no reply at all. He wrote one back saying, I've got loads of work but no money. So I said, what if I do some of the work for you and for free? And he said, well, I get 10 of these a day, what can you offer? And I said, I'll deliver anything you want me to. And he said, okay, there's these genetic mice and that have adapted from the lowlands to the highlands, like house mice we find here. And that's kind of an issue in humans, because you have lowlanders who go to highlands, the highlands in the mountains, the copper mines to work, but they can't conceive. And if they do, it usually ends in a miscarriage, but vice versa, it's okay. So a highlander goes to the lowlands and they can have a family. And he says that those mice, in the mRNA and DNA, if you can isolate those, we can make a very easy comparison from the ones who adapted at the highlands and the lowlands to do a cross analysis and identify the genes. And this also has application in sport, because you can actually do a genetic screening of someone who could be better or less adapted to altitude training or altitude camps.
Or so breed, we've all... or breeding at altitude.
Yeah, breeding at altitude, yeah. I mean, I think that's probably the...
We don't know whether this is going to help the Olympics, but, you know, feel free whilst you're up there.
Yeah. So, yeah, that wasn't on the forefront of my mind, that breeding at altitude. But it was really intriguing, and actually it was a really interesting project. He just gave me like a plane ticket and 500 quid and just said, like, go figure it out. And yeah, so I had to basically catch mice. And that was a lot more difficult than it sounded, because, well, for example, a lab rat or a lab mouse that, you know, you sacrificed for science, they're weak, they're feeble, and there's no kind of fight back. But catching a wild mouse, it was war. Like, they didn't want to die. And it was an interesting concept, because they called me the Grande Gringo in that area of Peru, because I was this big guy, because in the Andes, they're quite small for some reason, probably due to the oxygen. And had to sort of live with them for sort of 4 or 5 weeks, and there was nothing there. And I mean nothing, you know, the toilet was a hole, and it was the village toilet. So it was definitely an experience I'll never forget. And, you know, things that did help me in the future, for example, building relationships, trust, understanding, persistence. So it was something that actually helped me way more than I thought it would.
So, enormous initiative to do that. Can you speak Spanish or Portuguese or whichever was the language?
No, it was just a lot of pointing. They had a dial-up internet connection, and Google Translate was in its kind of infancy. So it was very much like, okay, once this... It was an internet cafe. It was someone's house with an internet line. When it was open, you could go in and type stuff in. A lot of it was pointing and, you know, pidgin Spanish. And they could not speak a word of English.
So have you always been quite optimistic, ambitious, gung-ho, whatever the right term is, of, you know, just, I'm hearing about mail merging, I'm hearing about, you know, firing out links, I'm hearing someone like you saying, look, here's a hook if you want it, but 1,000 people would have gone no, and you went off not knowing what that was going to look like. Has that always been a characteristic for you?
Yeah, and I'm an optimistic guy inherently, but also I don't let someone say it can't. If someone tells you it can't be done, it doesn't mean it can't be done. It's that person's opinion says it can't be done. And I guess when I, yeah, and you call it initiative, ambition, but I just like getting stuff done and achieving something. And it was more of a challenge that I accepted, and not one that had any kind of, you know, revenge or chip on the shoulder kind of challenge that you want to sort of prove someone wrong. You just want to prove that you can do it and it can be done more than anything. And I guess that sort of trait, now that you highlighted it, is kind of really necessary in coaching and in the elite world, because, yeah, people want to hear that you can do it rather than, yeah, this can't be done, guys. Let's just go home.
So complete the story. What happened? Did you just come back with some mice in a freezer bag? And Hugh went, what did you say?
Thanks, mate. Yeah, I was like, yeah, I told you I was a man for the job. No, so it was really bizarre. I ended up in a Peruvian court, because Andean DNA is considered, like, not sacred is the wrong word, but of quite individual and can't be monetized or used for sort of any purposes other than the people who produce that DNA. And so I had to plead a case to this, the Department of Horticulture, Agriculture, or something like that, that can we transport this DNA legally? And that Hugh was just like, look, we can't take this or use this in any kind, because, you know, it's just not legal. So I went about doing that. And we got that passed through, this really oddly worded letter But I remember giving it to someone who was fluent in Spanish and English. He was like, this is a really oddly worded letter. They said, we can't get in your way to transport the DNA out. So that was one thing. And the other thing as well was trying to actually get the DNA out. So it was in liquid nitrogen or a dry shipper. And no one would touch it apart from one carrier. And getting out of there was insane. But it ended up getting transported to the University of Nebraska. And it ended up being taken there, which was great. And they got it. And they were going to analyze it like almost 10 years later. That was 8 years later. Then COVID hit. And just the whole thing just shut down. So I haven't actually checked up on it, what's happened. But the last time I checked, they have all the samples to run the study. So should probably check in on them, actually.
We've had this amazing Peruvian adventure. We don't know the answer about the highland mice and the lowland mice.
Yeah. What part of the DNA makes you adapted to high altitude or not? Cool. To be continued.
What an adventure. That sounds just incredible. And a huge tangent off the subject of sport, but tell us a lot about your character and your willingness to just give it a go and problem solve and get into trouble, but also, I guess, push the limits in that sense. It sort of probably links. I don't know whether we could make the same link from accountancy to elite sports coaching, but we definitely could from that type of adventure.
Yeah, I don't think the accountancy thing was probably the reason why I didn't make an accountancy.
You're good at handling numbers. Maybe there's something in that. So working as a sports scientist, so there is a specific role there in terms of understanding event determinants, progress, monitoring, and so on. I want to ask you about sort of that transition into coaching, but if I just hold you there in that sports science space for a moment, if people are listening and thinking, he's that guy who's doing this incredible work over in the Netherlands, and they're tuning in to listen to your understanding of sort of the determinants of performance. What did you find out either in your research or your work working with performers, cycling or British cycling or since, that you could sort of summarize the determinants of performance for the cycling success? You pick an event and start unpacking that for me.
I've worked in so many events. Say, for example, in cycling, I've done the kilo. That's probably the one that's always been the constant in my career as a scientist and as a coach. Or the kilometer time trial, should I say.
Yeah.
There's team pursuit, there's team sprint. I mean, well, you pick. It should be the kilometer because it's the cleanest and the easiest.
We should
one
go
to
for the kilometer because it should come back because it's so beautiful and hardcore.
Yeah, it's quite gladiatorial, isn't it? And kind of, yeah, bizarre. So, I mean, for everyone who's listening, the kilometer is... four laps of the track from a stationary start, fastest time wins. Like I said, it's quite gladiatorial. In the final, you go off one by one by one from slowest to fastest, and so the pressure's always on the next person to perform. Now, as I said, it's a four-lap event of a kilometre long, so 250 metres a lap from a stationary start. Now, you can look at all sorts of angles of the start, the acceleration, the peak speed, the deceleration, fatigue management on the physiological side or the propulsion side. And then you have the mass to get off the line, the rolling resistance of the tires, the aerodynamics. So for all those listening, anything over 60 kilometers an hour, but at 60 kilometers an hour, I think over 98% of the resistance comes from aerodynamics. So that's quite important. And these peak speeds in the world record attempt we did in October, I think the peak speed hit was close to 80 kilometers an hour. So it's almost entirely when it gets to that aerodynamic resistance. And when I first started coaching it, I just thought, what is the determinant of performance? Okay, we have it's peak speed. If you can get to a higher peak speed on the biggest gear possible, the fatigue is less. The reason why the bigger gear is important means that it's fewer contractions per second, or, you know, per revolution, or longer it takes to per contraction, which then fatigues the muscle less, so you don't rev out. But also you need to get to that peak speed as well, so there's a balance. And so I front-loaded everything on the strength to get off the start and the mass. So essentially coming out the gate, or the first quarter half lap, I focused everything on that. So we did a lot of gym sessions, a lot of start, and the only thing we really did for the fatigue management side was broken intervals. So we did a start for two laps, had a 3 or 4 lap break, and then went again for another two laps. And yeah, so I just came to the point of, how do I achieve peak speed? It's by getting the acceleration right, how to get acceleration right, get the start right, how to get the start right. And there's a paper that's going to come out soon where it basically just says, if you, it's peak power to mass, which was what my PhD was on, but what determines peak power off the start is max torque rather than max cadence. So basically, get strong and be able to produce that in a cycling specific position, and then you can't go far wrong. Since I've been working with Akilo as staff member or coach, we've always won. The personal team I've worked with have always won, so I've never lost Akilo yet. So it's worked so far. I mean, it might be defunct soon, but that's how I sort of broke it down and how I approached it.
So that is quite a grand view of it. So it's a very simple version of what would ultimately be very complex. But you would have had to have sort of dismissed either perhaps some maybe dogma or some assumptions. Say, for example, you need to do some, let me use an old fashioned term, lactate tolerance type work, where you've got to just persist beyond that sort of 40 seconds worth, that most people who've done any really high intensity intervals will know that sensation of all out exercise is very painful and you just want to give up. It's the only thing that I know of that can warp the space time continuum and slow things down. But you would have had to have done a little bit of, actually, you know what, we need to stop doing some of that, which I assume also would have required you to have convinced a few people of a different approach.
You're right, that's a really good point. Cycling, or track cycling, I think maybe even cycling as a whole, is full of dogma and status quo. And I do feel a lot of my time is trying to persuade people of a different view. Now, the thing that was always coming back to me, especially in my early years, was you've never ridden a bike before at a high level. And that is true. I've never competitively competed on a bike. But it doesn't mean I can't help you go fast. And I think once you can break that barrier down and sort of open a few minds, people will follow. So I just knew I had to be right on for one or two people, for other people to follow as well. You are right. There was a lot of questions about the lactate tolerance, or length, as they call it. And I just said, look, you've always done this type of training and you've always gone this fast. Let's try this type of training. And I broke down exactly what the determinants and why I thought it was useful, and try to give them, as I think the in vogue term is, empowering the athletes and knowing why they're doing it, rather than do it because I say. And the reason why I did that is, A, that's my nature, but B, they weren't going to just say, oh, this guy's won a world record or been a world champion before. He knows what he's doing. It's more of, okay, I have to explain my way of thinking rather than tell you my way of thinking for you to buy in. Now, out of the six people I had in that group, I think sort of 3 to 4 bought into it, and then subsequently went on to break the world record. I think more and more people did join in and got equal success. So yeah, there was a lot of, I don't know how you call it, people skills, persuasion, sort of explaining to get the buy-in that they needed. Yeah.
Mm. And so was that statistically based in terms of, say, that quarter lap correlated with peak torque, and therefore peak torque correlated with kilo time? Or what was it determinants of performance, therefore we need to focus on this bit?
Yeah, so what was interesting, actually, the statistics they had was, if you're leading at 500, you will win the race.
Okay.
Sort of, you know, more often than not. But then I used examples where in the most important sort of races, that wasn't always true. You'd probably finish in the top three for a medal, but we weren't after a medal, we were after the gold. So it was more about sort of dispelling the myth that, okay, this, while that statistic is true to a degree, if you look at this one, sort of, and I did break down exactly how you said it, like, you know, the peak speed is correct and does correlate to 500 meter time, but there's another 500 meters as well that you have to go through. So if you can get to the peak speed higher on the bigger gear, this is what will happen. And basically, if you just get to the half lap, the first half lap, quicker than everyone else on the bigger gear, you're going to win. Now, you need two or three people to kind of help prove you right. But you only need to be right once in coaching to get buy-in, in my opinion. And like I said, it's kind of one of those Bell diagrams where, you know, there's a segment of the people who do have the buy-in and then the rest will come eventually. And that's how it did work. It was almost textbook. So it was, yeah, it was kind of trying to shift away from an age-old statistic to maybe a data, not data, but data we'd collected of how it was going to work.
Mm. And so was that a British Cycling? Was that with the Power Guys?
That was, yeah. Yeah, okay. It was the Power Guys. The tandems in particular.
And then was that level of logic and application of, I guess, first principles thinking, you know, if you've done the homework in terms of creating the case, here's the business case for it. And then, here's an example of the program that would need to perhaps deliver that so that they could sort of see what the future might look like. Was that then a case of them asking you to say, right, guide us, coach us? Because the difference between sports scientists often is you might want to think about this. Here's what the data says. Here's your progress. Here's my recommendations. But the actual administration of it is often down to the coaches integrating sessions, adapting sessions. Was that the tipping point when people said, right, well, you lead it then?
No, it was the tipping point was a level of frustration where it wasn't getting administered to the riders. So I just said, you know what, I want to be the guy to take the responsibility and administer it myself. And if it doesn't work, then I'll stick my hand up and go, yeah, I'm not good enough. But that's the reason I went into coaching, because there was a lot of pushback, a lot of reluctance for a coach to really buy into it. And I'm not saying from a judgmental point of view, that they had, you know, the tools and skills they had, and they did what they think was right. They woke up and said, I'm going to slow these guys down. And I think maybe it wasn't explained well enough to the riders or anything like that, or the riders didn't know. And I just thought, why don't I just cut out the middleman, which is me, and become the person who not only comes up with the program, but also administers it as well. And luckily they took a punt on me.
Yeah. They said, yeah, go for it. You're willing to put yourself forward. We'll let you go for it.
Yeah. It was an interesting one actually, because I was doing the work with the Who What Bike team, or then called KGF, the team formerly known as KGF. And we had some really good sort of buy-in there with their team pursuit, and I was really enjoying it. And what was really good about them was they were just so open with everything and saying, look, tell us everything you know. We want to, it was almost trying to rein them in, being like, guys, you know, let's just get like some consistency here rather than just try and out-engineer people or just try every single training method. Let's just do, you know, something with that. And that really invigorated me and I guess invigorated them as well. And we got some really good success out of it in the World Cup series. And then I think Paul Barrett, who was the head of performance at British Cycling there, he sort of recommended that, Mehdi, why don't you, I know you haven't made some big fans of British Cycling, but I think it'd be really good for this job. Why don't you apply? Because you can clearly persuade people to take big risks at high moments. Why don't you go for it? And yeah, I applied. And as I say, the rest is history.
Mm. We've had Dan Bigham on the podcast before, so I can imagine that that was, and he mentioned you, that I can imagine that was quite a rich conversation, to say the least.
Yeah, it was, we were kind of like yin and yang. I don't mean that in a negative. It was just, it was a sort of perfect combination where he was kind of energy out and I was energy in. and it worked really well. And yeah, like I said, Dan Bigham's an interesting character. Like, he seems to polarize people. Like, some people think he's the sort of the saving grace of cycling. I don't think people think he's the devil in sort of in a different guise. I'm on the savior. I think he's great. He's brought the openness, the engineering, the innovation back and out to the mainstream, which has really helped the standard of the sport increase and the availability and the commercial stuff and getting rid of all these sort of internal structures. So having conversations with him really good because he's always open. He knows stuff. He knows what he knows, and he's very open to say what he doesn't know. And I think, I don't know whether it's we share the same optimism, but that guy's optimism and self-belief is incredible to the point I'm envious. Like, I think if you put on him a start line with Usain Bolt in his prime and say, you know, do you want a 100-meter race? I genuinely think Dan would, deep down inside, think that he could beat him and be really gutted if he didn't. And I think that's an admirable quality. I think that's something that I'd love to have.
Bike versus Bolt sounds good. you might want to get a smaller gear to start off with. Success at Rio with the Power Guys, and then what? What happened then?
So I was a sports scientist, sort of an interim basis there. I became a sports scientist after Rio, and then it was after, I can't remember when, but it kind of coincided with me kind of finishing my PhD there, and then I became the coach. And I felt like I hit my glass ceiling there. Like, I was interested in, you know, we'd broken world records without the equipment, or the specialist equipment, they say, for the Olympics, and I really wanted to push the boundaries further. And look, you know, British cycling have their own sort of plan and agenda, and I think they had a category for me or a box for me, and they viewed me as whatever they viewed me as. And I was a bit more ambitious and sort of sought opportunity. So two nations approached me. One of them was the Netherlands. And I just thought that it was just unlimited potential there. It was a big risk. Like, we just found that we were expecting our first child. And so it was agreed that we'd commute, or I'd commute back and forth because we didn't have any support network. But it's been an amazing experience from start to finish with them, my journey with those guys, which still hasn't ended yet, by the way. So I'm not talking in the past tense, but it was really interesting how they were, you know, the comparisons and contrasts with British cycling and the Dutch Cycling Federation. And yeah, and just the much more different and almost enriching journey that I had with them and that I never would have had probably anywhere else.
So just unpack that for me a little bit in terms of moving to a different system. Okay, Para program's I'm assuming that's going to be smaller than the Olympic program in terms of budget and resource and so on. But what was the difference and contrast between scale, system, budget, the support team that you had access to?
Yeah, good question. So the Para program, I think, was getting 8 million quid from British Cycling. I think it was 8 million. The Olympic program for the Dutch team was 4. So we had half the Para budget of GB Cycling.
And do you know what the Olympic version, British Cycling Olympic program would have been?
Yeah, the time was 30. So this is euros, 30 million euros, and we're getting 40. So it's about a sixth or over a sixth in terms of 18% of what British Cycling get. And in contrast, to give you an example, the Para, when I was a Para coach or sports scientist, they had a physiologist, a performance analyst, a doctor, a physiotherapist. These are all full-time, by the way, a strength and conditioning coach, a nutritionist, a psychologist. So that's already seven that I can rattle off immediately. There's probably one or two more that I've forgotten. Whereas in the Dutch cycling team, our S&C coach is 2 days a week. Physio is 2 days a week. Our nutritionist is 1 day a week. Our doctor is kind of 5 hours a week. And yeah, there was only sort of two full-time members of staff exclusively for the sprint team, Olympic sprint team, and members were obviously spread with endurance and sprint as well. So it was a lot more stripped back. There was a lot less money to play with, but and I kind of that fit into my profile of trying to be innovative, thinking outside the box, being shrewd with your money, making relationships with external partners and sponsors, and trying to make the best use of it. Whereas, we didn't have that kind of power or resource, and not power and resource. I meant like, you know, that we could make those decisions at a high level and at the coalface as British Cycling.
So just clarify, what was the new role? You took the new role on at with the Netherlands, and what was the scope of that role? Because I'm assuming perhaps with a smaller budget, there's going to be a tighter focus to the events that you want to specialise in, or the talent that you want to progress, as opposed to let's dominate every event or let's try and approach all of the events.
Yeah, so my official title when I first signed was scientist and coach. So it was a hybrid role and kind of a, if the shoe fits, wear it. Like if your expertise can help, do it. And if it doesn't, then yeah, no problem. So from a science point of view, it was all I cared about was how can I make the biggest difference from an equipment point of view and a training point of view and where. So my biggest focus was on the women. I'm trying to improve them. And you know, that ended up in Tokyo. Well, I was actually responsible for the women in the end, but in Tokyo, where we won the gold medal in the Keirin with Shannon Brest-Bennix. He's literally just retired this week. And it was, I don't know if you saw it, but it was quite a dominant performance through the rounds, and it was she was a worthy winner. But, you know, that was the coaching aspect, and the coaching aspect was more kind of the training aspect as well, trying to write the schedules and the training and the sort of the details within that. And the science point of view was more kind of broad of trying to make sure that we've got the best equipment for the best, or for as all the riders as possible. And it was more of a holistic approach. It wasn't like a hierarchy, because he or she is the best rider, they get it first. It was trying to get it out as equally as possible, because they had some quite dominant endurance riders like Kirsten Wilder, who I think is like a 9-time world champion. So we had to make sure everyone benefited from the tech or science point of view as well. But you know, it wasn't exclusive to that. It was, like I said, though, it was the if the shoe fits, you have to wear it. So I did some work with the men as well, and it was more kind of a dynamic relationship with sort of the main coach, which is Hugo, and it worked really well.
And so from your point of view, stepping into that role, which is constrained, but it's more pervasive into the program, more responsibility across the board, probably I'd imagine you went in a little bit and thought, where are all the staff? Oh, I've got to do that. What did that require of you? How did you approach it? Did you channel your Peruvian mice finding skills there?
I should patent that, Peruvian mice finding skills. No, it was a shock, because it was so far from what I was used to. So for example, at British Cycling, do any effort, there's kind of, I think it's called machine learning, that they figure out, you know, the computer figures out what effort you've done, and it gives you the time. You didn't have to label it if you didn't have to. Whereas here, we barely implemented electronic timing. Timing to the out the gate, which was really important for a team sprint, still hadn't really been done before. It was still quite rudimentary. Now, I had a number of different options or paths to go down. You know, some said, you know, you should go down training management or load management and that sort of aspect. But I refused to do, not refused. I thought that wasn't the best way of my time. I just thought, get the big basics right. And what I mean by that is everyone uses the word basic. No one actually knows what it means, but I'd say to make sure you get all the information you need to improve your performance. It doesn't have to be monitoring, but you know, times, power output, the best physiological training program, the best technology, the best skin suit, the best helmet. And the way I did that, I mean, that's a long list of things. I had to engage with external partners. And this is a skill actually used not only from the Peruvian days, but also with when I was with KGF, we had to engage with external partners to help our cause too. And it's more about, I say partners, not sponsors, because it's a, you know, we'll give you some insight and some data of what our guys can do with your product. And we'll give you some feedback. And if it's something worthy of it, then we'll ride it. And if it's not, we won't, but we can give you some feedback on if it's good or not. And so it was kind of managing processes of other people who actually had no obligation to me, to try and get as most out of it as I could.
My assumption was that you're now not just cutting and pasting some of the ideas. Well, this was our hit list of priorities in British cycling. I'm assuming you're having to really constrain your thinking, as in we're not going to do this. We are going to prioritize these aspects, and creating the case for investment, maybe partnerships, but also again that behavior change. So it sounds like there's a lot of sorting in terms of right priorities, going from the riches to not the rags, but the limitation dread led thinking.
Yeah, and a great example is like the team sprint. These guys produce like over 500 newton meters off the start, which is incredible. Like I can't really put into a reference how good that is or not, and to the average person, but it's incredible. These are big guys. But to give you an example, if you look at the pictures, we rode these Shimano cranks, which were made in the 90s, because we knew they were stiff enough, and you know, whether they're aerodynamic or not didn't really matter, because the energy we'd have to put in to get something, you know, super stiff, super aerodynamic and looking good was just not, the juice wasn't worth the squeeze.
In terms of the project effort to try and get either manufacturing or to find the right product, you said that's good enough for now to be able to handle the load.
Yeah, that's good enough. And any energy we invest into it, the return we get in performance just wouldn't be worth it. Yeah, so so it was just more about, okay, what does improve performance? What matters most? And in the priority list, so skin suits, overshoes, you know, a bike that fits, you know, the systems, the handlebars and the frames coming together, the tires, that sort of stuff we did have control over. And we did have to, for example, the rolling resistance, we had to do it using our own rollers, the power meter, and I think it's called an odometer, but a speed meter, and trying to figure out, okay, of all these tires, which ones are better, which ones are worse, and we had to do it ourselves, whereas normally you can just send off to a manufacturer, pay them a sum of money, and they return it back to you. But we had to do it all in-house. But that was no problem. At a training camp, we with a mechanic, we tested all the tires, and we came to the conclusion, got the... they're the ones we invested for Tokyo. So it was more about investing, prioritizing, like the amount of investment it would need for it to have a performance impact, and could we economize and do it ourselves? And if so, like how much labor would it cost? And yeah, we just focus on the big things.
And So I've got a couple of questions there that are just occurring to me. One is, did that first of all require that the athletes were more bought in because you needed them as active users? You needed them to be doing these additional trials and tests as opposed to the sort of off the shelf done for you. It's solved overnight and we don't have to think about it.
We actually kept the athletes out of it. So okay. For example, the rolling resistance stuff, you can use any, I mean, I'm a heavy person. Obviously I'm very muscly, I could ride the bike as well on a set of rollers. So we actually tried to keep the athletes out of it as much as we could.
Okay.
Just not distract them, because it was, you know, we had to sort of narrow it in. What was good about the athletes were we did keep them aware of the process and what we were trying to achieve and how we were trying to achieve it and the updates of everything. But in the end, we just presented to them in Tokyo what we've chosen, why, and how we've gone about it. So, you know, we're very open with why we chose this particular skin suit or overshoe or tire or helmet. What is the advantages of it to the competitors or to what we had before? And yeah, this is what we're going to do and this is why we're going to ride it. So they didn't have to do any runs themselves. And we actually made a mannequin that we could actually do these stuff, the tests ourselves on a wind tunnel. And not the wind tunnel time was kind of quid pro, where we said, look, you know, you can advertise that we're measuring with you, but can we have a discount rate rather than €1,000 an hour, please? Which we can't. So yeah, it's all about trying to innovate and think outside the box.
And so I don't want to sort of get into, British Cycling are doing this and that's not right necessarily, but what's your big observations of the sort of feast and famine? If you've got endless resources, what would be your observations of the things that perhaps the traps you can fall into, and the benefits of having a reduced budget and a limited approach? What would you see the contrast being?
The real negative or the real downside is the situation we're in. The Dutch is we have such little room for error. We've got a very small team. If one person falls sick, the whole thing can potentially fall apart. We can't make any errors in judgment in terms of what we want to select and not select. Time is a lot tighter. There's no specialist in British Cycling. You know, it's a really nice luxury to have. You've got a lot more money. You have a lot more specialists. You can make a lot more mistakes. And if you are ill, the whole program isn't going to fall down overnight. And you know, you can give it to a team or a discipline of people who will go away and potentially come back and find the solution. The flip side to that is that could be a bit clunky if the management skills aren't correct. I mean, I'm not in British Cycling anymore. I can't comment. But when you introduce more people, it's essentially you have good management. But like I said, you know, the time scales are much broader. You know, you can have much more resources and you can make much more or many more mistakes. Whereas with us, while we can make very quick decisions and we're quite agile in terms of, okay, this isn't right, we need to go for this one. And, you know, it's the case of a few emails or a few meetings and it's done. The flip side to that is it's non-experts making decisions and we're having to work with external people who actually owe us nothing and we owe them nothing. So it's kind of on good faith. Whereas if you hire an expert or a consultant, you expect an output because someone's reputation's on the line there. So it's pros and cons. I mean, there are times where, you know, I'm very thankful that the position I'm in, I think, you know, we can make these decisions really quickly. And, you know, I'm one of two or three people who need to make these decisions. On the other hand, you know, when my son is ill and I can't go and you really rely on other people and they have no obligation to do it either. You know, your job. There's pros and cons for both of it.
Mm. And so, and what about you've mentioned a few different areas. What are the skills that are now different for you, Mehdi? What are the things that you've thought, actually, I'm going to have to upgrade my abilities here to be able to navigate that type of landscape?
Well, yeah, good question. When I was at British Cycling, it was solely about the riders and nothing else really mattered. Like, you could do some innovation and changing bikes, but you needed like a mechanic there and you need the rider there. It was all kind of a lot of, for good reason, there was a lot of process and people needed to do small changes. In terms of the big thing for me is not only a group of riders I have to worry about, you have to manage up as well to let people know that what you're doing, and you have to be almost be the looking glass for both ways, for management and the riders. And also you have to understand that there are a lot of relationships that you need to engage in. So almost being able to manage, engage and build relationships that there's no... I guess the best way is build non-transactional relationships with people that you don't need to. So I keep talking about these external partners. Like I said, they have no obligation and vice versa. So you have to kind of build an element of trust. And like I said, I guess the best way of putting it is a non-transactional relationship. I'm not paying you money and expecting something in return. We're working together to find the best product that you can make and whether we can wear it or not. And that's the big thing. Whereas in British Cycling, is just like, this is the best kit and you're going to ride it. And people know that, so they don't object.
Now, you've got broad shoulders, very muscular broad shoulders. What's the demand on you as a coach? Because it sounds like, I mean, when you step into coaching, there is a very different level of responsibility. You do feel the weight of accountability. But I'm wondering whether that's dialed up even more so when you've got so many or so few people bearing that responsibility. You've got to sort of take more on. How do you cope?
I don't really know. Actually, I guess since I started, the dynamics in elite sport has changed. So WhatsApp is kind of the main mode of communication, whereas previously it was like email or even a good old-fashioned phone call. So it's definitely 24/7 now. Now, I'm to blame for that as well. Like, I reciprocate that. I humour it and go along with it. I do have to put a lot of more responsibility on the riders. So, you know, sometimes I can't be there and I have to have more trust in the staff that I do have. So, you know, this guy has to be there on this date and deliver it. And I can't micromanage. Not that I would want to anyway, it's cost too much. But for example, a gym coach say, this is what I need, X, Y, Z, in a meeting with a rider. Can you deliver it? Can you just put it on a file for me, on a cloud or Dropbox, whatever, for me to look at? And if there's any problems, I'll let you know. So it's more about the way you cope is you have to trust the expertise around you, even if it's more limited. There's no reason why you can't do that in a bigger team or with more resources, but you have to be a hell of a lot more organized and you have to have you just have to be more flexible in your communication. And unfortunately, you know, the boundaries are a lot less, or they can be a lot less. It is exhausting, but when you have the passion for it, you can push it further than you think.
Mm. And so if you're looking for other people to sort of come on board, and I haven't got a budget for you to snap up, but if you were looking for someone to work with a program like yours, and perhaps even if you were in a different role, what would be the qualities that you'd be looking for from them?
The first one is proactiveness, and the second one is delivery. And the reason why I say that is, I do get as interns, which we just do pay the travel costs for, and that's the two qualities I do look for. And the good news is that every intern I've had has gone to have a full-time job in elite sport or a PhD. But all I care about is you don't have to be an expert. You just have to be proactive, and you just have to be able to get it done. And I use myself as an example. I don't think I'm particularly clever. Like, the papers I read, I would have to read 6-7 times, and I couldn't even read it in one sitting. So it's more just kind of, you know, I'm not one of these people who can sit down and say, oh, do you read so-and-so et al. And their paper and this? I just can't. I'm just not that sort of wired that way. But if they have a will in a way, like, that's what I encourage. And ultimately, I say, this is what I want it to look like. by this date. You know, I'll check in every now and again. But ultimately, this is on you to go and figure out how it works, how it doesn't work. And at the end, this is what I want it to look like. That's what I care about, really, because I can't be with them every step of the way. So I'm not actually looking for experts in sports science or experts in cycling. It's more the characteristics they show.
Yeah, okay. Bright enough, but the wherewithal and the character to go, let's do it, let's make it happen, and actually go and back it up. Okay, so we're in Olympic year. What's happening now for you? What's sort of the day-to-day look like?
Not much, actually. All that happens is just the intensity increases. So, you know, people obviously, track cycling is solely dependent on the Olympics. So every program exists because of the Olympics. So, you know, the intensity, the anxiety, will they, won't they get picked? Am I going in the right direction? Everything's magnified. So if they get an injury, it's just going to be the end of me. You know, am I going to recover in time? And everything's just heightened. You know, normally you say as a coach, look, this isn't the Olympics, to try and calm them down. But, you know, kind of we're getting close to the Olympics, so we can't just say, yeah, this isn't the Olympics. But it's more about kind of, for me, you've got to embrace the pressure. You can't just try and sort of not make it a thing or try not to humor or entertain it. You have to sort of say, this is the biggest thing you're going to do, but let's embrace it. Let's put some pressure on in the training, or let's put some pressure on you here and there. Like, when you get to the Olympics, it shouldn't be like this monumental step up mentally, physically, emotionally. You should be already sort of well-versed in that. So it's more about putting them in the positions they already are. For riders who are not dead cert medalists, I quite enjoy this part because you can gamble a bit more with the training. And my sort of mantra is, if you're not going to get a medal, what's the difference between 4th and 10th? Because, you know, if all about medals, like, if you're coming in at 6th, who cares if you come forward and just roll the dice and go for gold? So, yeah, for me, it does come with an element of excitement, more so than usual. But also, there is pressure as well, I'm not going to lie, but I signed up for this. So I'm not going to complain about it, and I think we should all embrace it, and that's what I try and encourage as well.
And what's the breadth of responses or thoughts and approaches that you get from the athletes and coaches? Do you have to be a bit of a steadying force for them, but also be flexible enough to say, okay, they need a little bit of this, they need a little bit of that?
It's different for every person. And that's one of the big things I've learned with coaching is that you read these books about, you know, this, or coaches always say, you know, if I was a coach, I would treat them all the same. And you just can't. They're just not the same people. They have different upbringings, different values, different outlook, different points of view. You know, for some people, they have quite turbulent lives, and you have to be that kind of steady person. Other people like being hyped up. Other people just like, you know, hold analysis of their situation. Like, this is where you are. This is where you need to be. To go from A to B, this is what you need to do. Like, go figure. Other people need kind of an arm around the shoulder. Other people need a rocket up their backside. And it's a dynamic relationship. It's not like this person always needs this. You know, coaching is an interesting position because it's not completely transactional relationship you have with athletes, but it's not completely, I don't know what the opposite of transactional relationship is, but it's never one or the other, and it's always in between, and it's constantly changing, because, you know, they might be suspicious, you might try to out them of the team, or, you know, you said something and they might interpret it, or, you know, you've said they're really good and, you know, they think they really trust you. But the reality of it is, I mean, for me, I spoke to myself, is like, you have to put your trusting foot forward and always take the non-transactional side of the relationship and always do best for them. So, yeah, I've happily fought for riders who, you know, don't particularly trust me, or at that time anyway, But, you know, my job is to help them. And that's what I'll always kind of sincerely do anyway.
Yeah, I'm trying to puzzle what the opposite of transactional in that context is. Maybe there's some sort of, I know certain models of trust have got this intimacy as a word, and I know Sophia Jowett talks about closeness. I suppose there does need to be a distance and a barrier, but not too much. You have to be very close, arm around the shoulder, parental, sort of familial, but you also need to have that objectivity and that distance as a parent almost. I don't know.
Yeah, it's but either way, like I think people think that it's a, you know, every person, when they say everyone's different, that this is how the relationship is, but it's constantly dynamic. And I think people don't really appreciate that enough, that how it's always constantly changing.
And so have other nations caught up, and the sort of Beijing, London, to a certain extent, Rio, British blitz in track cycling, it feels to a certain extent that other nations are catching up. And if so, what's your sort of attention to that? How much are you observing and watching other people's performances?
Yeah, of course they are. And you know, there's the I wouldn't say it's the end of the British blitz. I think the team pursuit in Tokyo were very unlucky. I mean, they weren't going to win gold, but I think they still won the medals table in the end. I think we were second in the Olympics. It's the countries have caught up, but only a few. I do want that. I think that's only healthy for the sport. And that's one of the things the IOC are keen on. They are considering the future of track cycling. And the reason why they're considering whether it should be in the Olympics or not is they're saying that the same old people are winning every time. And it's that there's not enough parity and it's too equipment focused, which is, you know, I do understand. I do think there should be a level of innovation. I think Dan rang me up having a go at me, Dan Bigham, saying that they should all be on the same equipment. I didn't mean it like that, but I was like, if you want it to be a completely fair race and fair racing, that's the only way I can think of. But I do like the innovation side of cycling, because it's kind of like F1 on two wheels rather than four. But yeah, I mean, Italy, usually with the exception of the Netherlands and the GB, the more money you invest, the more successful you become. And there is a good graphic somewhere on the Twitter sphere that does show that. So, you know, Italy, for example, they're getting a lot better in the team pursuit. They won the Olympic gold, and they're quite dominant in the endurance events, and they're getting a men's sprint group that are coming up quite well. But they're the second most funded nation after GB. Australia, always there or thereabouts. But, you know, I quite like the fact that is not just one nation dominating. I might be wrong in the Olympics. GB might dominate everything again. But either way, for the World Championships, it's always nice to see different people dominating and winning.
Yeah, and I tend to agree. I think whilst it actually served the medal table quite well for home Olympics, I can imagine just how unimpressive that is as a sport. So everybody just turns up to watch the Brits win. So, and that does feel like progress when other nations are starting to compete or outbid. All those they're matching those times and more so. And so, without giving it all away, because I'm sure you'll keep your cards close to your chest for this question, but maybe if you can give us a few hints, where do you think there's the next advantage? Where if you had a bit of research money or some investment money, or if as you're starting to get close to the games and you're starting to think there's something in this, but maybe not for now, maybe for the next cycle, where would you say that advantage would come from?
I would say it's training sciences. I think there's still a lot to gain in cycling and definitely the track. But I think because of the aero revolution or evolution, you want to call it, it's all just been focused on that. And I think it will come back to training sciences again. and the specificity of the certain events. For example, team sprint. And I think more people would be, yeah, if there was a pot of money I had that you said, after the Olympics, where would you want to do it? I want to do it into training sciences, because I think there is a lot more to be gained there than we think. I believe we can push the boundaries a bit more.
Can you give us can you give me a little bit more on that? Just any
yeah, sure. So for example, doing double gym days, you know, for example, that's kind of something that's rarely done, but that it's kind of not viewed as in track cycling. That's something I've thought would be quite interesting, because, you know, people just don't do double gym days, but just because they haven't done it before doesn't mean it shouldn't be investigated. I also think the crank length is quite an interesting one, relative to the height of the rider, or the femur, or the shank of the rider. I think, you know, you have different sizes in particularly in starters of this team sprint, who do the first lap only. And does the crank length actually improve anything? I mean, there's some stuff out there, but there's, when we've played around with it, it's been a lot more messier than what it suggests out there. I also think the training, the stuff we do in the gym is interesting. Like power clean and back squat was just the holy grail, but I don't think that's the only way to become strong in cycling. I believe it's a convenient way, and a quite an easy way, or a accepted way, but it's not doing it's the only way. And yeah, just playing around with the training. I think a lot of programs are stuck to this Monday to Friday training routine. I mean, we kind of played around with that a bit with the Dutch, and tried to incorporate the 7-day week into a training program rather than the 5-day week, with good success. I mean, you know, who's to say that that won't change? But yeah. Does that go into a bit more depth as you were hoping for?
No, that's good enough. And that, what I like about that is you used a word there about play around with it. And what that doesn't mean is just mess about it. It's logic based testing and learning, as you say, you know, that initial intervention that you're referring to around focusing on that peak torque for that first quarter lap. Let's give it a go. And if we're getting results, great. We'll do a little bit more of it. We'll continue to do that. And it's the willingness to break models that we rely on, that just set in stone long ago for whatever reason, which might be more to do with opening times of the velodrome or the swimming pool or the track than logic as to why you need to do that. That feels like a space where, for individuals at the very least, you can see what might be a better progress for them, what might optimize their ability at their age and their stage and their development.
Yeah, I think about the one thing I would also do is try and take some sort of pressure off the younger athletes. I think right now we have a lot of people burning out quite quickly and having to specialize and be quite, that needing to be quick, really quickly. And I think the fun is sucked out of it a bit. And you see a lot of people retiring from the sport quite quickly when you thought they had a bit of potential. And obviously there's different, everyone's got their own personal lives and stuff that we can't control for. But I do think, you know, if you look at Chris Hoy and that generation of riders, you know, they came in from having had, maybe they went to university or a job first, and they really relished in the high performance when it went full time. Whereas, you know, you look at a lot of people, you know, they're giving all these performance plans and targets and stuff really early on. And I think that's just, we need to bring the fun back into it and then start introducing kind of the elite planning and performance setting of you know, determinants of performance and stuff like that.
Is that a moral thing, or is that actually just trying to preserve careers and having people that are more capable than perhaps just pressing a pedal?
It's more of a sustainable thing in terms of I guess being sustainable and moral are kind of, in this case, they're kind of interlinked here, because you have a responsibility. You know, you are entrusted with this person's life from an early age, not to a point, you know, they're coming from, you know, a war-torn place and you having to look after them, but they're in a vulnerable state in terms of their formative years, and you have a responsibility. The last thing you want to do is beat the life out of them and make them kind of detest the sport. And you know, there's a reason why people get in this sport, because they enjoy it, usually. And that should always be preserved. And then, you know, the serious stuff should come a lot later. But I think this is more of a societal thing than an actual track cycling.
Mm. Yeah, well, here. How are you going to keep the fun involved over the next 6 months as you go to close to the Olympics?
Good question. Good question. I think with them at the moment, the path the Olympians or the future Olympians are going to be on, it is getting fun and energy out of the whole process, is the kind of the what we consider the high performance, you know, performance planning, targets, that sort of thing, is what energizes them and helps them perform better and enjoy the performance better. And I think they probably enjoy the outcome more than the actual task of doing it. You know, whether they're doing a flying 200 meters or a kilometer, they enjoy the outcome more. So it's more kind of, you know, planning the process to get the outcome right. So I think it's more about that. It's also not being too hard on them and not being too soft. It's having to find that balance of, look, let's put it all in context. Let's not panic. Let's not get ahead of ourselves, which sounds a bit of a killjoy, but it's just kind of managing emotions, because, you know, one minute you think you're going to win the Olympics, next minute you're the worst thing that's ever walked the face of this earth. And the reality is, if you're world-class yesterday, you're world-class today. So, you know, by and large, you're the same person. It's just every day you make those changes. So to answer your question, how am I going to make it more fun? It's just have everything there in place for the process and help them enjoy the process, but also not be too hung up on the process. Like, just make sure they're doing the fundamentals, which is, you know, eating well, sleeping well, training well.
Mm. Yeah, I like that approach. I think it does sound like a bit of a killjoy, because elite sports are a roller coaster, and the lows are really low and they're gravitational, and the highs are incredible. But when actually what we probably need is to even it out a little bit, even because it's still glittering, it's still exciting, it's still inspiring for people. It perhaps doesn't need to be as wearing as the, yeah. I think that's possibly the big reflection of my career, at least, anyway. Hey, look, I love talking to you, Mehdi. It's been fascinating to listen to you today, but also really incredible to see how you've taken your thinking, applied it to a different system with outstanding success, and more power to you, literally and metaphorically, and I'm wishing you all the success for Paris this year.
May the watts be with me.
May the watts be with you.
Appreciate it, Steve. Thank you very much.
that's something you can look at a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
Appreciate it, Steve. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for taking the time to listen. I really hope you enjoyed this week's conversation. Now, we've got plenty more to come, so if you'd like to support and champion us, then take the time to subscribe and leave a review on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or wherever you tune in. You can also give us a follow on Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. All the links are in the show notes. So in the meantime, have a great week.